Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
And welcome to the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show here on the Voice of Vachon. We're located on beautiful Vachon Island in Washington State. That was the voice of Brian Brown, who is the creator of the Brown Briefly. Brian started the Briefly and brought his high standards of intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy. And Brian's motto was, less is more. More or less, and of course, he always offered much, much more. I introduced the Briefly panel this morning. We've got our Legal Eagle, our consensus builder, former Washington State Assistant Attorney General, Fulbright Scholar, Crevin?
Kevin Jones.
That's a combination of Craig and Kevin, if you wanted to know. Crevin.
I like that. Merged.
I like that. So good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Briefly.
Sorry about that. Okay, so now, how about avid defender of justice, mariner, cyclist, and top secret engineer, Kevin Jones.
Who's that?
Who is that guy?
Good to be here with you, Truman.
Thank you. We've got historian, professor, party animal, down under aficionado, Bruce Hallman. Good morning, Bruce.
Hey, good to be here this morning.
That way I didn't get yours messed up, at least. And last but of course not least, our fairy maven, part-time politico, playwright, and full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreher. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. It's almost time for shenanigans this weekend.
Uh-oh. I'm Truman O'Brien. I'm sitting behind the big red switch here in the Gene Bosch studio in beautiful downtown Vachon. Today is what we've begun to call the Truman Show. That's when we don't have a guest. And so the pressure's on for me to come up with something to talk about, as if that were difficult with this group. But before we get going here, let's go around the table and see what we've all been up to. Let's start with you, Craig.
Yeah, I was sort of in my head reviewing the past week, and I thought, I didn't do anything. And then I looked at my calendar,
I
realized I did do a few things. Last Tuesday after the show that evening, I had CERT training. We had CPR bleeding, stopping, and fentanyl. Narcan treatment, and those sort of things. So that was good. CERT, for those of you who don't know, is the Community Emergency Response Team, which you can become a member of.
And you should.
Yes. It's something that it could be very, very useful and has been in the past on the island. Everything from search and rescue to major disasters. The second thing that came to mind was I had my first Thursday morning scramble on the Voice of Vachon, and our theme was an homage to our friends in Canada and Mexico. I thought it would be appropriate to let them know that there are some of us who are still their friends. And then on Friday night, on First Friday, I came in here and listened to Cat Eggleston perform right here at the Voice of Vachon studio in downtown or uptown Vachon. It was a good week.
You know, I was going to mention, you said, did I lose my train of thought? I heard it going out of the station. I'll come back to it.
Okay.
Doggone it. Where'd it go?
We've all been there.
I see it floating around.
It's in there somewhere.
Catch a star.
What did you say the first thing? You did what? No, you did.
First thing was the search.
Oh, I know. I got it now. I was talking about your show.
Oh, yeah.
And I just wanted to remind folks that the Voice of Vachon has a new website. I mean, we've redone our website. It's really pretty darn good.
Mm-hmm. It's spectacular.
It really, don't you think? Yeah, I think it looks great.
Much easier to find stuff on there.
Well, except that you don't look for shows like you used to do. You go to TuneIn and then radio shows, and then you'll get to see all of the shows.
That is one of the issues that I have with it, because I was on the team that helped put that together, and I thought, that some people might have a little trouble with that one.
Yeah, people do, including me, until I figured it out. But, so you go to TuneIn, Then you go to radio shows, and then you'll see all of the shows that are on. And if the letter in the alphabet is not lit up, we have no shows to start with that letter. So
it's broken down into music shows and talk shows.
And talk shows, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's really quite good.
We can see the Voice of Vashon Monitor, all those people rushing out right now to listen to those past versions of Brown Briefly. Thank
That's
you.
That's right. That's right. Thanks. Yeah. And also you can listen to us on a podcast if you like. If you get your podcast on Spotify, for example, you can hear us there. So Amy, how about you?
Yeah, big week as well. Of course, last week there was the press conference with Governor Ferguson that, you know, launched 1,000 ships and messaging
literally
ships. That was exciting. And then also last weekend was the Vashon Repertory Theater Playwright Incubator series. And a place like this, written by Deb McCabe and directed by Casey Alanis, and I sort of assisted with that and got to see it all come together on Thursday night, and that was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed being part of that process. So that was a great highlight to see it in VCA and the talk back and see the community, you know, really engage with it. I just, you know, the way this community engages with art is really, really cool.
I agree. 100%. How about you, Bruce?
Well, an important week. My son turned 50.
Oh,
last week,
geez.
Which is always a reality check. So
yeah, that hurts.
50 used to be old, man.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like, wow. But he, for his birthday, his wife gave him a solo trip. So he got away from the kids. I've got a 3-year-old, a 7-year-old, and an 11-year-old.
Oh,
and so he went up on the Clipper to Victoria and just had 3 days by himself. And Victoria is just a great place to visit.
Oh, yeah.
And this time of year, there's not hordes of tourists. And so he had a really relaxing, great sort of time. The other thing going on, I was contacted by a fellow, Paul Stevenson, lives here on the island. He's completing a master's degree in historic preservation at Birmingham University in England. He's British. And he was talking to me about what are some great sort of projects for, he's looking at doing some papers and then doing a thesis. And so I talked to him about the Mukai property and that whole battle, sort of a 15-year battle, if you will, from, you know, it being purchased by island landmarks and then the struggle and sort of it declining, then a group coming together, sort of wresting control of it, 3-year court fight. And now it's sort of one of the gems of the island. And so I think he's really going to focus on that for a couple papers and then possibly his thesis. So it'll be a great way to sort of capture that piece of Vashon history. And then on Friday night, the museum had an opening of an exhibit called Hidden Treasures, which is a great concept. It's all those things in the back of the museum that people never see. And so there's about a half dozen really fascinating objects on display. And so if you get a chance, drop by. Take a look at it.
Is that going to rotate now? Then
what we're going to do is it's only going to be up for 3 months, and then in May we're going to open an exhibit that's don't have a working title for it, but it's basically the Sherman Collection. So the Sherman family, which came here in the 1870s, has an immense collection of Native artifacts that they were traded and given when they were early settlers on the island. But their property is one of the largest village sites on Vashon. And so they're finding all kinds of things. And in fact, Jim Sherman's son, walking down the road one day, saw this thing sticking out of the clay bank. And he dug it out. And it's this beautiful feast bowl. It's about, you know, 2 feet long,
foot
wide. And so we working with the Puyallup tribe and with Brandon Raynaud, the archaeologist and tribal historian there. And so we'll have a show this spring showing that collection in conjunction with Puyallup tribe. And so it'll be really neat
really
kind of
cool.
exhibit.
Yeah. So. Great. So Kevin, how about you?
You know, speaking of the Puyallup tribe and the artifacts, today I was walking down to the water to launch the double that I was in with my good buddy Rob, and walking across that Shell Midden Beach, right, was sort of like, that's really kind of takes you back to the people who used to be here, and of course still are here, right, spent so much time, and So that was great. But I got out on the water this morning, so that was really fine. I was not sure that I was going to be able to because I had a 10 o'clock meeting here in town, and thought, I think I can make it. So yeah, I was on Vashon time. So that was good.
Everybody
was cool with that. But also, I got the bike back on the road, the Peugeot Super Competition. So we launch right out of here from Colvo Sundays at 9 o'clock. And I wasn't sure. I did not keep up with the fast guys, but at least I hung on the back wheel for a while. So yeah, it's good to get out.
Good. Well, I had a great weekend. Before I tell you about this, though, I have to tell you, I have been to many, many, many plays and productions in New York, Vancouver, Toronto, London, Seattle, of course, and for the for the last 40 years, a couple of times a year, we go down to Ashland, Oregon for plays. So I feel like I've got some background, so I know what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, I got to see Mercy, which is the play that our guest from last week wrote. That's Elizabeth Heffron and Hope Wetchkin. I'm telling you, folks, it is superb. I mean, the writing, Elizabeth just did a brilliant job. And the music, by golly, the music is great. I mean, Hope is a physician, but she kept up with her music, thank goodness, because it is really, really excellent. And you saw it, did you not, Amy?
I did not. I wasn't.
You didn't
able
get to see it. Yeah. Oh gosh, it was just great. And I have to tell you, I'm pretty impressed with the group that they came to do the reading. They had a large group, of course. It was a huge cast, but the narrator was Chris Basha, and he did a great job. They brought in a pianist from Seattle. I don't remember his name, but anyway, very, very, very good. I can see this going all the way. I really
right
can.
On.
It's just superb. And it's a wonderful, the topic is quite timely as well. But anyway, so that was my day, my week.
More power to them.
Yeah. Oh, I wish them the best of luck. Today, a significant day, obviously, is National Johnny Appleseed Day, which I think is kind of cool. Johnny Appleseed was actually born John Chapman in 1774. He was an American pioneer and nurseryman, and he introduced trees from apple seeds and others, of course, and primarily in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Ontario, which I think is pretty cool. And anything to add to that, Bruce?
No, I mean it's that first phase of Western expansion, the end of the Trans-Appalachian West, and he played a significant role because most of the farms at that point were subsistence farms. Mm-hmm. They would sell some of the goods, but they had to grow their own food.
Yeah.
And so Johnny Appleseed didn't just do apple trees. Yeah. He did all kinds of fruit trees. And so it just became a staple. Every farm had small orchards and mostly for their own use. And so that's why he gets this kind of mythic status in American
expansion
culture.
Expanding that.
I remember, I'd heard Johnny Appleseed like we all did probably at a very early age, but our Boy Scout troop back in Ohio went to I think it's Brown County, beautiful area of central Indiana, and they had a 50-mile Johnny Appleseed Trail there. And along the way, it talked about various aspects of the history of Johnny Appleseed. It was it's fascinating, and one of the most beautiful trails I've ever been on.
Oh, that's great. So also today is National Promposal Day. I love that name, Promposal. This is the day. Now, I read a little thing. It says, that proms take a lot of planning, including finding the right tux, the right dress, the shoes, the accessories. Did mom teach you to dance, or do you take dance lessons? Are you going to borrow dad's car? Are you going to get a limo? All of these things. But today is the day that you ask your date. So I thought that was kind of promposal. It's a new name a new word for me. Also today, March 11th, is Lawrence Welk's birthday. He was born in 1903. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Some of us had to suffer through those shows.
Some of us did. Some
of us did. Our parents watching or whatever.
Exactly. I think your wife probably can address that, being from South Dakota.
One of the great things about Lawrence Welk was he had an accordionist in his band.
Yes.
Marion Florence.
Yes.
And when I was at University of Texas, there's a place called Bronzeville, Bronzeville, yep. Texas, yep. where they have an Oktoberfest every year. And the highlight of it, and they would do it at an old Army Air Force base in a hangar.
Yeah.
But the highlight would be Marion Florin coming in and playing the accordion and all this sort of German polka kind of music and stuff. And man, and of course, beer and buckets and all that kind of stuff. A great experience, but I'll always link Lawrence Welk to Marion Florin. And New Bronzeville and the Oktoberfest. I mean, it's just great.
You know, we have a number of accordion players on the island.
Oh, yeah.
One of whom you know quite well, Guido.
Really? Is it Guido Perlis?
He plays an accordion as well as a guitar.
So. I played the accordion for a while.
Oh, there you go.
Just for a while, yeah.
I really want to have Vashon Accordion Fest, like bring in Vashonk.
Vashonk right, can do it,
and get the accordions. And Danny, if you're listening,
there you go.
This needs to happen.
When I was in the Army in basic training, I was part of a band for my unit. And we were told that we had to win the competition at the end of training, which we did not do, by the way. But one of the people we had in the band was a guy who played a cordovox, which is an electric accordion. And I'm telling you, this guy was amazing. He could play jazz, rock and roll, you name it. He could play it on that accordion. The guy was really good. But anyway, so there we go. All right, so today in history, 1669, Mount Etna erupted. The largest eruption killed 15,000 people, if you can imagine, Mount Etna. In 1789, Benjamin Banneker and Pierre Charles Lefond began the layout of Washington, D.C. And I knew about Pierre Charles Lefond because there's a Lefond Square in Washington. But I did not know about Benjamin Banneker. He was a black guy who was an engineer, and he worked with Pierre Lefond to work that out. And also, I didn't realize that Pierre was he was at Valley Forge. He was with George Washington during that time. Anyway, thought that was kind of interesting. Well, here's one for you, Bruce. 1845, the Flagstaff War in New Zealand. I'm not going to name these chiefs, but they they chopped down the British flagpole and drove the settlers out of the British colonial settlement of... You can probably tell us what that is. But it was because of the breaches of the 1840 Treaty of Waitangi.
Wanahiki.
Wanahiki.
Sort of a revered figure in Maori New Zealand culture. Yeah, that sort of first resistance to the British colony in New Zealand. And the Treaty of Waitangi is sort of the basic, it's kind of like the Magna Carta in England. It's kind of the basic document, because New Zealand, like Britain, doesn't have a constitution, a written constitution. It's a constitution of practice and tradition. And the Treaty of Waitangi is the basis of that in New Zealand. And right now, there's a conservative right-wing government in New Zealand that's trying to rewrite the Treaty of Waitangi, and that is creating lots of conflicts.
Boy, I'll bet.
What percentage... the Maori make in the legislature?
About 18% of the population.
How about the legislature?
It's interesting. There are four designated Maori seats in Parliament, and then there are a number of other Maoris who represent districts. And I think, I'm trying to remember, New Zealand has a unicameral legislature, so they got away from two houses, sort of like Nebraska, and just one Parliament, if you will. And I don't remember what the total number is. I don't think there's 100 in it, but I think there's probably about, 10-12% of representatives in the government.
Mr. Maori.
Yeah, but it's a very different sort of relationship than we have with Native people here, because with Native people here, we have treaties which, ignored or not, have legal standing in the courts, whether the courts hold them up or not. But in New Zealand, there's just one treaty, and it applies to everybody. So it's an interesting situation.
Well, and I think the Maoris were, of course, a lot stronger than, I mean, the relationship between the Maoris and the settlers was much different than the relationship here.
Right, yeah. You know? Because the Maoris were never fully conquered militarily.
Right, exactly.
You know, and you know, what began as musket wars, the introduction of muskets into New Zealand, empowered Maori people to resist British colonization. I mean, not to say that the British didn't ultimately overwhelm Maoris and push them aside and ignore treaties and land agreements and that kind of stuff, but there's a basic sort of ability for Maori people to sort of resist that, and the fact that they're, you know, what, 18-19% of the population.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Native people here are what, 2-3% of the population.
Right. Right.
I mean, it's a big difference.
Big difference.
I always thought it was interesting that the relationship is so much different than the indigenous members of Australia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Just that, which is so close.
Sure.
Yeah. And how their relationship to the government is, you know, totally different than the Maori, because the Maori put up a pretty good fight.
Yeah, and Aboriginal people did too, but they were, you know, they were much more dispersed and much smaller groups, and there were never any treaties signed in Australia, so there was no legal recourse. Whereas in the United States, with treaties, which were like international treaties in effect between the U.S. government and tribal governments, even though they weren't always treated that way in the courts, ultimately they have that standing. Whereas in New Zealand has the Treaty of Waitangi, but Australia has no legal recourse.
Huh.
You know, and Aboriginal people weren't even citizens until 1962.
62?
Yeah, right.
Wow.
Yeah, so,
wow.
Whereas in the United States, you know, Native Americans become citizens in 1934, I think it was. And then in New Zealand, Maoris have always been citizens. So real interesting sort of three different models, if you will.
Fascinating, fascinating. All right, so in history, in 1935, Hermann Göring officially creates the Luftwaffe. I thought that was interesting. And in 1963, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara orders the adoption of the U.S. military, the M16 rifle, which originally was designated the R-15, of course, developed by Eugene Stoner. I thought that was interesting. And my time in the Army in 66, I never was issued an M16. I was said the M14 still. So it was still, even though it was introduced in 62, it took a long time to get introduced to the military as a whole. I thought that was interesting. 1997, Paul McCartney is knighted by Queen Elizabeth. He became Sir Paul McCartney. I thought that was kind of cool. And it's the, in 2011, the 9.0 magnitude earthquake, which caused the huge, in Sendai, Japan, the huge tsunami that wiped out the Fukushima nuclear plant, and all that happened on this date. And then last 2020, COVID-19 declared a pandemic by the head of the World Health Organization. And by the way, did we pull out of that? Or I know Trump tried to. Did we do it, or did he?
I think it's been threatened. I don't know if it takes a while to actually, like the Paris Climate Accord, it takes like a year. But I don't know about the WHO. I'd have to do the research.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't.
I think somebody's doing the research right now.
I can see that.
Yeah.
On that Google machine.
By the way, it was declared this after 121,564 cases worldwide and 4,373 deaths, which is pretty amazing to me.
5 years ago today, huh?
Yep, 5 years ago today.
Yeah, it was just on the news this morning. They had a thing about that, and I think it was 1.13 million Americans died during that pandemic. So.
Wow.
For all those deniers out there, it's sort of like, you know, it's real.
Yeah, boy, is it ever. Wow. Okay, folks, to get into our talk section here. Amy, so what's the latest in the fairy news?
Well, the latest is Governor Ferguson's announcement on Thursday morning that they will be delaying the conversion of the last two Jumbo Mark 2s and once the Yakima comes back, they're going to keep that in the water, and that will restore the fleet up to 18 boats, which is theoretically enough to restore full domestic service. So that would be enough to give Port Townsend Coopville their route, their second boat, Bremerton their second boat, and the third boat for Vashon. So that is per the governor's announcement scheduled for summer. To launch with the summer sailing. And, you know, we are right now sort of thinking that, of course, it takes Washington State Ferry some time to iron out kinks. And we know that there will, of course, be some troubles because our fleet continues to age. Right. But we are very heartened by this news. This was a big deal, right, for Ferguson to take action to delay that at least until after 2026 summer sailing. So that'll give us at least a full year, if not more. And the question then becomes, do they delay those hybrid conversions until we get the new boats in the water, right?
So yeah, but gosh, isn't that going to be like 29 or 30?
Yeah, 2028, 2029, right? You know, so the question then becomes, you know, will communities settle again for reduced service, you know, by pulling those boats out of the water? And, you know, part of what Ferguson said was that this technology is constantly evolving because it is, right? You know, right now, Washington State, by committing to build these two new hybrid electric ferries, is the front runner, right? Instead of letting, you know, there's a lot of chatter about, you know, should we let private industry do this first? Mm-hmm. Should we, right? We could kind of talk about that for an entire show with some marine transit experts. But basically, Ferguson is kind of saying, you know, let's give it through 2026. Let's see where the technology goes. Talks with the shipyards. And of course, the Wenatchee conversion is delayed by, you know, it was supposed to take a year, almost 2 years now, 30 some million over, you know, over budget with that conversion. Wow. So it didn't go well, right? Yeah. The Wenatchee conversion has not gone well. And, you know, pulling boats out of the water to continue those conversions is risky at best. So we are very grateful for Governor Ferguson, you know, honoring his commitment to address the ferry crisis. And, you know, we know that there will be thises and thats over the summer. But this does allow Washington State Ferries more flexibility. And, you know, our next message, because there's always a next message and we still have a lot of work to do. Mm-hmm. But the next message is, you know, we fully expect Washington State Ferries to honor the most recent service restoration plan that Vashon Island and the Triangle Route is first in line for restoration. They have, you know, said sort of, you know, they're already soft pedaling it and saying, you know, well, we, you know, so, you know, that service restoration plan is sort of, you know, so, you know, our next step now is to thank Governor Ferguson, thank WSF for their work, and to, you know, say, hey, there was a reason that the Triangle Route, we are the fourth largest ridership, was first in line. We expect you to fulfill your commitment.
Now, will the 18 boats give us a reserve? I mean, will there be...
So there are 18 boats in the water and 21 in the fleet right now that are operable.
Okay.
And, you know, so there won't be a reserve, so to speak. You know, the ones that are out of the water are out of the water for a reason. They're getting the retrofit, you know, et cetera.
Okay.
And so that means there's still not resilience in the fleet.
Right.
So, you know, we go up to three boats, we go down to two boats, right? Crewing, vessel availability. But again, we are celebrating this as a step forward.
Absolutely.
Right. The ghost boat was a step forward, right? Going back to three boats is a step forward. And, you know, we are also... They have convened the working group to improve the two-boat schedule, which they're already trying to get out front of the messaging on that and calling it the premium two-boat schedule. We'll see about that.
Well, changing the name really makes a huge difference.
Yeah, right. Well, the whole ghost boat, bonus boat thing didn't go well for them because ghost boat's just more fun. I mean, come on. But, you know, so the working group will convene, and it includes, I'll sit on it, Wendy Amon from the FAC, who also works with IFA will sit on it. Jordan Saltman is going to sit on it, the ferry friend developer. So there will be great representation from Vashon in this two-boat schedule remodel. And we're excited about that, because when we do have to default back to that two boat, which we know will still happen, it should be a more versatile schedule for Vashon.
And what's the deal on the mosquito fleet now?
So the Mosquito Fleet Act 1923 is now cruising through the legislature. It is doing so well because they removed the funding mechanism. There was a block grant program attached to it, which they removed to get out of house. But it's still important regionally because it will allow localities to set up and activate their ferry taxing districts. So it'll allow interlocal agreements. It'll allow ferry taxing districts, right? So that regions up and down the Sound can, you know, sort of create their own mosquito fleet. So it opens the door.
Would that be like Des Moines doing that, or would that be the island, or how?
It would be Des Moines could certainly do that. You know, there are a lot of places up and down the Sound. And, you know, the other thing that was sort of I would say actually amended into the bill is that it will only cover now Puget Sound and Grays Harbor. So, for instance, you know, Grays Harbor could set up their ferry taxing districts, and it removes some policy restrictions that have prohibited folks, and will allow that now. So it's an important step forward for the region, you know, and we'll see, you know, hopefully if we emerge from our budget crisis and solve some problems in the transportation budget, perhaps in the future, there may be block grant programs, because capitalization was an important piece of that block grant program, right? It's one thing to say, hey, we want to do it and operate it and raise the funds offset your farebacks. But, you know, buying those boats is also an important piece of.
And if I can jump in, that's an important part of what happened in the 40s, you know, when the Washington State Legislature tried to create a Washington State ferry system in 47, 48, it was declared unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court, and so they had to go back and redo it. It took a while, until 51, when the Washington State ferry systems formed. But what that bill had in it was the ability for local counties to create ferry districts. And that's what led Vashon to create, you know, King County Ferry District number one, and run a Vashon ferry system for 3 years on our own. And so it's a great model for what is coming. And the same thing applied when King County started the passenger-only ferry. You know, it did it under the provisions of that act. And now this will make it much easier to do that kind of thing.
You know, I can also throw in 1846, they established the King County Airport District number one here on Vashon. Yep. It was the first one. And we are a taxing district, although we don't, we haven't passed any levy
yet.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I'm not anticipating that might be a bit of a hard sell, given all the other issues. Yeah, Kevin.
So, Amy, all of the commentary during testimony about funding is having an impact, right, on this legislation, given that it's now the funding has been removed from the legislation. So has the team thought about next steps and what happens after this? Or is this sort of the end of the road for moving this forward?
I don't think it's the end of the road. You know, we're still in partnership with Des Moines and historic Seattle downtown, South downtown. As far as establishing a new route, you know, whether or not we pursue other grant opportunities, right? So the mosquito fleet, that was always an avenue for us to establish potentially new service and potentially expanded service. So as far as the passenger boat goes, we will still be advocating for the appropriation introduced by Senator Alvarado to retain midday service and potentially expand to weekends. So that's, you know, we still will need to be very active in talking with the legislature about that. And in some ways, our task is a little bit more difficult because that funding was always intended to be stopgap, right, while the boats were down and while we were in the crisis. But even Governor Ferguson, during the press event last week, himself said, you know, we know that we're not out of this crisis yet. We know that we will continue to face reliability challenges, resiliency challenges. You know, we're not hanging up the mission accomplished banner, right? And then the other piece that's important is HB 1264, which is in, I think, moving over to the Senate side now, passed out. But that is a really important bill that will mandate that the Office of Financial Management improve and expand their salary surveys when they're before they go into collective bargaining. So it's a little bit wonkier, but basically it's saying to the OFM, you know, you need to compare comparables when you're talking about how much you're going to pay our crew. That needs to include the private sector, right? It needs to include specific other marine transit industries. So really, that's, we're very supportive of that as a mechanism to support our crew wages for equitable and attractive crew wages, which is a huge priority.
Huge, huge.
Yeah, let me ask too. I mean, one of the pieces of the equation is the pipeline bringing new crew in. And they seem to have gotten on top of that. I mean, there's still a ways to go, but they've essentially got people in the pipeline. Is that your assessment?
So the MMP union, which is the masters, mates, and pilots, has a program up and running that is doing well. And their union rep, Daniel Tuig, when he speaks about it, feels very optimistic about their pipeline and how they've really solved some of those problems. The engineers continue to struggle partly because of wages, right? Because disparity in wages and the attractiveness of wages. And the engineers will, of course, you know, we have that silver tsunami coming up for them in a couple years. And, you know, we know that crewing challenges exist. There will still be tons of overtime demanded to come back up to full domestic service, right? We know, and I, you know, just to opine a little bit, there's of course a lot of, you know, I'm the first person to say free beer tomorrow when it comes to WSF, right? Yeah. But what I will always push back on is sort of like, well, yeah, we should, why? Well, you're just wasting your time. And why is Vashon even doing this? And, you know, this doesn't mean anything. And, you know, there's always, every time you take a step forward, right, there's always folks who say, my armchair quarterback position, and, you know, just want to really reiterate that we have taken steps forward for the past 2 years, right? Yeah. There's no silver bullet. Organizing is never easy. Winning political victories is never immediate. And so I think the patience and the dedication that so many Islanders have shown, and again, even though we have this victory, we're still going to have to continue to fight. Yeah. And we know that. And, you know, we are just so thrilled that so much of Vashon has continued to push forward on this.
I was just going to say thank you very much for your efforts, Amy. You've been just a dynamo in driving that forward, and I think it really shows.
Yeah, the IFA group has just been, I mean, you couldn't have assembled a better team.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will just continue to push my vision that was part of my testimony, was that, you know, despite all the hopefulness, I don't, let me take away from the victories. I totally get that. But I look at what we had with three-boat service, with crews, and the WSF, still, can they run on time? Mm-hmm. And right, so there's always this sort of challenge of the service. Great mm-hmm. service. I had advocated before, don't let that boat leave until it's full, right? Yeah. Even though you're going to be off schedule, because the whole thing is moving cars, but moving people, and the ability to move people without having to move your car with you, right? The idea that King County Water Taxis can synchronize with Metro Transit and be and do so in a reliable way.
Yeah.
And so to really be able to seamlessly connect people without having to, you know, drive your car to the North End parking lot, blah, blah, blah. You know, how can we make that happen? So, and, you know, the per person carbon emissions on WSF water King County Water Taxis is much less than on those big boats, WSF boats. So, you know, there's also some climate advantage to moving in that direction, depending on the market and how many people you really have to move. Because an empty boat, you know, doesn't do you any, you know, puts out a lot of emissions for no passengers. But, and we'll see where that goes. But I'm glad to see the team is still focused and trying to figure out what progress looks like and how to get there.
Yeah, well, and, you know, with the water taxi technology continues to evolve, smaller hybrid electric, you know, water taxis mm-hmm. that, you know, are more appropriate for Vashon. You know, I could wonk out on why we have the ones that we do today, but that is coming forward, and we do need to invest in water taxi. And, you know, we are prepared again for that water taxi fight should the legislature say, oh, hey, mission accomplished. Right. We don't need that water taxi anymore. Right. You know, we are ready to push back on that. And we are also ready to assertively start the conversation with King County about how many sailings West Seattle gets versus Vashon. And, you know, should we need to get scrappy in that fight? I think we have a really compelling discussion to put forward about West Seattle versus Vashon service. So we'll push on that. And then the other piece, Kevin, is, you know, we are hoping to continue work with Councilmember Mosqueda. She is very much in tune with metro service on Vashon and the lack of metro service. And there is that study. There's money for funds for that study. And, you know, the multimodal piece of IFA has introduced a couple of proposals for them to improve metro. And one of them is real-time signage down on the dock, right, that says the next bus will come. The next bus to take you to Vashon Town, right, for tourists and travelers alike is also really critical.
Cool. Then the next step is to improve the King County Transit Planner, which always routed me through Tacoma when I wanted to go up to the Seattle Center.
That app is tough, man. That app is tough.
So many opportunities.
So, Kevin, I'm sorry, but rowing shells are not going to be going to Des Moines.
Now, wait a minute.
I
have heard stories. I have heard this is true, that there was a group in an 8 that went over to the Tides Tavern to have lunch.
Oh, really? So it's possible.
I heard there was a guy in a rowboat who went to Taco Bell at 2 in the morning, right?
Could happen here.
Yeah, right. So, Kevin, how about Indivisible Vashon? What's the latest going on there? You got some big projects going.
Well, you know, we're gathering. We're sort of looking at the gathering storm, number one, and we're gathering on Thursday at the Presbyterian Church. Doors open at 6:30. Meeting starts at 7. Presbyterian Church, right across from the Gene Bosch bustling and bodacious Voice of Vashon studio. Show up at the north door. Come on in. See what's going on. We will actually have door prizes, so that's a new thing. We have some new energy on the leadership team.
So is this going to be in the sanctuary or in the?
It's going to be in the social hall.
Yeah, in the back. Okay.
Yeah, but come on in into the foyer, and you'll see a number of opportunities there to chat with folks about things that they're doing. We're going to hear from our new rallies and protest focus group leader about folks who want to get out there and have their peaceful voice be heard. About their reaction and response to what they're seeing from our new federal government. So we got that. In addition to all the conventional things that we're doing, for example, we've looked at the upcoming 2025 election. You know, we're going to have elections for Washington state legislators in 2025. Mm-hmm. And probably the most competitive one of those is going to be right across Colville's Passage in the 26th legislative district, where Emily Randall is now in Congress. Yay, Emily. We did a lot of door knocking for her, and she won her first race by like 104 votes or something like that. Wow. We probably had 5 or 6 trips of a dozen people go knock doors, so I think one or two of those votes belongs to Vashon. But her seat is now filled with an appointment, Deborah Krishnadasan. Krishnadasan, I believe, is how you pronounce her last name. Michelle Caldier, who is a very stable Republican House of Representatives member, is, we hear, going to be running to compete for that Senate seat.
And so we've
actually been working to try to retire Michelle for quite a few years, and it hasn't happened yet. So that race, I think, is going to be extremely important, and that's going to happen this year, 2025. Okay. But so we're looking ahead. We've looked at all of the congressional races for the Senate and the House, as well as the state legislatures, like Minnesota and Michigan, lost their Democratic trifecta in 2024. Right. Who would have thought?
Yeah.
And by only like 1 or 2 seats. So we've identified now seats that look very competitive in those districts, and we're compiling the resources about how people can support them to kind of move that needle back, you know, towards the left. Which is where we all on Indivisible Vashon want to push it. So if you're interested in hearing more, if you're interested in figuring out how to be part of that, Show up on Thursday and hear from folks.
6:30 at the Presbyterian Church.
Doors open at 6:30. Okay. Meeting starts at 7. Probably run for an hour and a half. Part of what we hope to do is, if you've been to our meetings before, you've heard about our 9 focus groups. Mm-hmm. So you know, we've done a lot of talking to you. We listened to what people were concerned about, and then we said, well, here's what we think we can put together. Now we want to hear again what people want to do, and hopefully that'll be, oh, you want to do this? You need to talk to this person,
yeah, exactly,
who's in that focus group. Let's get people connected and working together so we can make a difference. You know, small but mighty, that's Vashon.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Loud. Vashon's loud, as we've heard.
So, yes. Yeah, we did share this resource by this research, by the way. There was a group in Boston, Swing Left, the Swing Blue Alliance in Boston. They used to be called Swing Left Greater Boston. And they're the ones who had always been able to do advocacy for progressive candidates in Maine, for example, which, of course, Susan Collins. Is it going to come up for re-election again this year? Mm. So, the Swing Blue Alliance, I attended one of their meetings, and they said, we want to do some election research, you want to do some volunteering, sign up, and so I did. And we finally got a chance to meet with them, and we presented the work we've done, and they looked at each other and said, okay, the research is done. Now what are we going to do?
Now what are we do, yeah. Oh, wow.
So they're going to be starting to talk to candidates. We hope to be able to understand the candidates who are running. We hope to understand the candidates who will challenge Republicans in those seats right now, because that's what we think progressivism is, more Democrat than Republican. And the idea is, let's reach out to Indivisible chapters across the country in those districts and see who they're planning to support, so we can plan to support them. So if you want to call some Indivisible groups in, you know, oh, I don't know, Philadelphia and maybe up in Maine, and connect with those folks and see how we can be helpful from here. That's what we're kind of game on to do.
All right. Well, to shift gears a little bit, I just wanted to tell you one quick thing here about Ukraine. We've been reading about removing the intelligence information from Ukraine. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the difference between strategic and tactical intelligence. Those are huge issues. And what they're really, what they're losing there is the strategic intelligence, and that is where the enemy is, what kind of capability they have, what is going to take to attack that, and so forth. That's what they're losing right now, and this whole dust off between Elon Musk and the president of Poland, and he's saying, you know, be careful because I could pull the plug on Starlink for you. I just find that incredibly upsetting.
Feels like Starlink is the weak spot. I think Musk is done with Tesla. I actually think he's leaving it in the dirt, and it's not generating as much revenue for him. Which, you know, great, burn your Tesla. But I honestly think that Starlink is the weak link.
Yeah, I agree. And if you look at it, I mean, I looked at it when I decided to change from DSL, which is incredibly slow, and I decided, you know, I'm just not going to do it. I mean, it's a great system, but no thanks.
That's one reason why, you know, public communication services, mm-hmm. telephones, things mm-hmm. like that, are regulated, you know, and you can do that on a national basis, but there's really not a mechanism right now for international regulations of public communications, if you will. And that's going to be an issue until governments around the world are willing to step up and say, hey, that's not a role for a private entrepreneur to mm-hmm. control communications and then be able to turn it off and shut it off at his whim.
At will, yeah.
No, it's not a good precedent.
Well, it's like the trains, you know, or the air, and used to be the airlines, not anymore. I mean, they're deregulated, but same sort of thing.
So is there an eminent domain opportunity here, if so moved by the federal government?
Well, it's difficult because, one, they're in space. where there's some space treaties, but they're not particularly enforceable that I understand. You know, it's who's got the eminent domain. I mean, you know, cutting off Ukraine or cutting off Poland or cutting off South Africa what does that have to do with the United States? I mean, it really is that sort of world government kind of issue, and the United Nations is the only body that has any standing but has no power. And so it's a dilemma right now, I think. Craig, I mean, you're more connected to the legal end of it.
Little to add, I don't see an eminent domain argument, and I'm all in favor of original and imaginative arguments. anything we can get our hands on. But no, I don't really see that. What we have is an extraordinarily difficult situation, troublesome situation, where a private individual controls a public utility, if you will, a public service, and you're relying on that individual's goodwill, or at least relying on the capitalist system rather than political influence.
So if we anticipate the expected changes that, for example, getting all those air traffic controllers to be, you know, pushed to the limit so that people demand a better FAA, et cetera, et cetera, and privatization is the right answer. We have privatization right now, SpaceX communications, and look where that's getting us. Mm-hmm. So if you want to think about, how bad could it get?
Healthcare.
It could get bad.
Healthcare. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. Did Mr. Smith and the Guiding Hand ever envision capitalists intentionally crashing an economy so that they could scoop up assets and consolidate them and then make money off that? I don't know that that was part of
They anticipated men and women of goodwill.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. And the invisible hand.
Right.
When the invisible hand becomes visible, that's when it becomes a problem.
Yeah, the deus ex machina is, yes, and I don't know, I think the invisible hand is very much visible. It's a fist right now. It is a solid fist.
Yeah, so the indivisible hand is getting people out so people know of our dissatisfaction. We're going to hopefully elect the right people, so show up on Thursday.
There you go.
Shameless self-promotion.
So. That's quite all right.
One more thing on self-promotion of indivisible. How many of you have had people say, I want to do something?
Yeah.
I don't know what to do. I want to just do something. Well, if you want some good ideas of what to do, come to the meeting on Thursday night at the Presbyterian Church.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, there's a new thing actually. There, we've done postcard writing for a long time. 22,000 postcards in this last election cycle from our little island. And so another thing going on right now, the leaders of Indivisible, Leah and Ezra, they're having like what's the plan every Thursday. And now at the at one of our local gathering spots here on the island, you can actually show up and listen to what they have to say. And they're talking about the real situation going on and what you can do about it. And then we are going to be there with some postcards. So you can write postcards. You can listen to Lee and Ezra. You can meet some buddies. Talk about, hey, what are we all going to think about this? And what are we maybe going to do to work together? And that's going to be discussed on Thursday as well. So if those things sound interesting, that's what you show up for. So
good.
Thanks, Craig.
Good. So, Bruce, one quick question here. I know that several states are talking about seceding, including Washington, Oregon, California, going to Canada. So other than the Civil War, has this ever been considered in the past by other? I mean, I know Texas.
It really hasn't. That's an interesting thing about it. Of course, the Civil War and the states that sort of have removed themselves from the Union. There was an 1869 case, Supreme Court case, decided unanimously by the Supreme Court, Texas versus White, that sort of ruled that secession is unconstitutional. You can jump in, Craig, but that's sort of the legal precedent right now. But again, there's been, except for the Civil War, there's no instances of U.S. states exiting.
Right.
Two things that did happen. One, the sort of area of the Northwest Territory, which was once contested by the United States, so north of the 48th parallel, what is now British Columbia into the eastern provinces a little bit. When the 48th parallel was set as the Canadian-U.S. border, those those parts of the U.S. Used to be U.S. territories, became Canada, part of Canada. And the other is the Philippines. The Philippines were an American protectorate.
Mm.
And the Treaty of Manila sort of released the Philippines from that, and they became the Republic of the Philippines. But those are the only examples. What's happening in what you referenced with Eastern Oregon, Eastern Washington, mm-hmm. you know, joining Idaho and that kind of, that's gone on a lot. You know, Maine separated from Massachusetts. You know, West Virginia and at the beginning of the Civil War separated from Virginia. There's been adjustments, particularly as territories became states, because territory boundaries were very ill-defined. And so as they became states, they needed to define their territory specifically. And that left areas that were deeded to other states or became part of other territories, sort of like the Oregon Territory, which is huge, you know, ultimately became Oregon, Washington, Idaho, parts of Montana, parts of Wyoming. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but no states other than at the Civil War have actually tried to remove themselves from the Union.
So what about the lot line adjustment or whatever it is that Trump's trying to pull with Canada, the Canadian border? What's going on with that? Do you know anything about that?
I just
heard him talking about it.
Craig, you might know more than I do.
Not really. Yeah. I mean, I think that's pie in the sky.
Yeah.
That's not called a lot line adjustment.
No,
that's called an invasion.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
How Putin of him.
Yes, exactly. Right. You know, I did want to build slightly on what you had said there, Bruce. You've dropped one little adjective, and the adjective is that there's no unilateral right to secession. You can secede if both houses and three-quarters of the states agree to it, and the chances of that are slim to none.
To none, yeah.
And then the end around is putting together like the Oregon, Idaho, Northern California thing that people are talking about there. It would appear that you just need the states to agree to it.
Oh.
And then be approved by Congress or by a majority.
Hmm.
That's sort of a different thing altogether.
Hmm.
We looked at that on Vashon.
Mm-hmm. Of seceding from King County, right?
Seceding from King County, seceding from the United States.
Really?
Seceding, yeah. We looked at every conceivable option we could come up with.
That first started in 1897, the first attempt to break Vashon away from King County. And you know, every 10 to 20 years, it sort of rears its head.
Yeah. Sounding good again.
Be careful of what you wish for.
Yeah.
What county are you trying to join? There hasn't been a
Weed County. Weed County.
That has been
a problem.
The last time that happened was about, 100 years ago or something?
Yeah.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
State legislature made it impossible for Vashon to succeed. So in the late 90s, sort of like it's a weed dream.
And do you really want some of the neighbors you know to be running this island?
Right?
Well, I do have to ask Craig, with that information about the states, you know, how badly behaved does a state have to be for three quarters of the other states to want them gone?
I really want to ask that question. And by the way, there have been hundreds of movements over the last 150 years to secede.
Oh, yeah.
And none of them have succeeded.
Succeeded to secede. All right. So, Amy, what do we got coming for next week?
Yeah, next week we will be hearing from Carrie Dawn Decker and Vashon Household. They are having their housing forum next Tuesday night at the Vashon Center for the Arts with Councilmember Mosqueda. Mary Bruno will be moderating that forum, a really important community discussion, as always. So next Thursday, check out Vashon Households, their website, for more information on that. So she'll be coming in, and I think she'll have some exciting announcements about next steps for VHH.
All right. Well, folks, we're about out of time, so I have to say for Bruce, Kevin, Craig, Amy, I'm Truman O'Brien. We certainly do appreciate you tuning in, and we look forward to seeing you again next week.